Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Well, welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and our executive producer and research assistant is Laura Kortner, and our engineer is Anita Brockington. Our guest tonight is an expert on Druids, the ancient Celtic class of religious leaders, legal authorities, lorekeepers, medical professionals, and political advisors. Now, for many years, I've been fascinated by this culture, who were described in the 4th century BCE by Julius Caesar and other Roman writers. The Druid orders were suppressed by the Roman government under the 1st century Roman emperors and had disappeared from the written record by the 2nd century. I wanted to know the facts about the Druids. I finally found a book on this subject that I could trust. It's called Secrets of the Druids, From Indo-European Origins to Modern Practice, and the author, Teresa Cross, is our guest for 2 hours tonight. After reading it, I discovered how much I had been misinformed. I have to admit, this book was a great challenge, in particular due to the many words in Gaelic, Irish, Welsh languages, etc. I guarantee I will embarrass myself a couple of times tonight, or maybe more than that, because I have to struggle through them. But I am so happy I did, because it was well worth the struggle to relearn everything I thought I already knew. Drawing on comparative mythology and linguistics, archaeological evidence and etymology, Teresa Cross offers readers a comprehensive course in the history and development of the Celtic spiritual tradition and its lore, reconstructing the Druidic faith from the remnants that have survived and the dedicated study of scholarly sources. She also reveals parallels with other Indo-European traditions, such as the similarities between Celtic and Vedic Hindu beliefs and practices. She chronicles the ethics and spiritual teachings of Druidism and the Celtic faith and examines what happened to these beliefs during centuries of Christianization. Teresa Cross has been a Celtic scholar since 1982 and was a member of numerous Celtic cultural organizations, including the Scottish Society of Dallas, Southwest Celtic Music Association, Clan Mackenzie Society, and the Irish PEC. She is the author of The Truth About the Druids and a frequent contributor to the Independent Celt. She lives in Kingman, Arizona. Welcome to 21st Century Radio, Teresa Cross.
Thank you very much.
I really enjoyed reading your book. It was a little tough for me, but I really enjoyed it. Druids.
I hope it wasn't too tough. I jam-packed as much information as I could into this book.
You sure did.
And I originally wrote it about a little over 30 years ago, and it was published by Llewellyn, and it was Rush, and they did a okay job on it, but this time a new edition, they decided to call it Secrets of the Druids, and despite the title, the secrets, one of the secrets of the Druids is that they didn't probably realize themselves that they were inheritors of an Indo-European tradition. I don't know if they could have been aware of it or not, but certainly the word Indo-European as a name for that language family was not created until the late 18th century, and 19th century. So, given that, I will reveal what the biggest secret of the Druids is, later on in the program, because it has to deal with a class of poets called the Fili, F-I-L-I, or F-I-L-I-D-H-E, in more modern Irish, who were poets, but the word originally meant seer, and we'll find out more about them as we go.
Well, Druids and their magic lore and rituals fascinate everyone with images of standing stones, mistletoe, golden sickles, white robe priests, and powerful sorcerers. But who were they really? Tell us, Teresa, who were the Celtic peoples and who were the Druids?
Well, nowadays, people who are descended from Gaelic-speaking Irish and Scots Gaels of the Highlands and Islands, the Welsh and modern Irish and modern Scottish Gaelic and the revived Cornish, which is similar to Welsh, and Breton, Breton, you may have heard of. They are Celts. And now the Galicians of northwestern Spain and just north of Portugal claim Celtic heritage, although the language that was spoken in ancient times died to Latin. And, of course, Galician language is also known as Gallego. But they want to count themselves as Celts, so we count them. And, of course, but if you're going to do that, places where Celtic languages were spoken and later were wiped out by Latin include Gaul, which is France, Belgium, and Switzerland. And Gaulish was a P-Celtic language. I'll get to that, the difference between P-Celtic and Q-Celtic. Julius Caesar, of all the classical commentaries, has, the in my opinion, the best information on Gaulish Druids. Because he knew a druid named Viciacus of the Aedui, who in 60 BC came to the Roman Senate because they were having trouble out of neighbors. They wanted to join the Roman Empire and address the Roman Senate in 60 BC. Viciacus himself came there. He was turned down for help from Rome. And Cicero wrote about it because he said a couple lines about Viciacus and his training. So then when Caesar came into Gaul, the Aedui were a tribe that was having problems with invaders from the north and east of them. And they wanted to set up an alliance with Caesar. And they did, but Viciacus' own brother, Dumnorix, ended up getting executed by Caesar.
Well, who were the Druids?
The Druids were the learned class of the Celtic peoples. And a lot of past antiquity and antiquarian writing wanted to say that the word Druid meant oak seer, from what would have been Deru, Deadwolf, plus Wade, meaning to see, there would be oak seers. But that isn't the etymology of it. The word Drew in Druid is a prefix meaning strong, steadfast, and unbending.
Strong,
and
steadfast.
And then Wade, meaning to see, is part of it.
Where did they come from?
Well, there are, there's a root of DNA going from the Indo-European homeland across the south part of Europe, going all the way to the west coast of Spain and the northern, northwestern places like the coastline of Gaul and the British Isles. And there's a nice book by what was her name? Let me see. There's a book in front of me here. Jean Manco. And it's about, called Bloodlines of the Celts. That you could read about that if you want to know about that end of it, having to do with DNA and where they migrated. Then there's a John W. Koch, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, because that could be pronounced anyways, K-O-C-H. And he said that Celtic was a language that developed in the east, that west coast of Europe, and intruded in toward Gaul and Central Europe. But that is a very controversial theory and not accepted by all Celtic scholars. The other is a more traditional or conventional view is that the Celts came from Indo-Europeans that settled Central Europe, and language developed about 2,000 years before the Christian era. And it's about the same time that the so-called Aryans of India had migrated all the way to the from the west to east, following the Indo-Iranian people's movement that way from Eastern Europe. And they were very, very conservative in keeping traditions, and so were on the west side of the Indo-European, you know, lands were the Celts. Now, there are similarities, great similarities between Hindu Vedic tradition and what we can put together of Celtic tradition from the scraps of knowledge that we have.
But what do we really know about the Druids and their practices?
Well, according to Julius Caesar, Druids presided over sacrifices. So in order to get at the rituals of sacrifices, we got sources such as the classical commentators who sometimes exaggerate things and even make up things about the Celts that were to foster either a noble savage type idea of them or to make them look as barbaric as they could. So they had a problem with the Celts, then it would show up in their work. later there was the Alexandrian school who said all kinds of, made up a lot of romantic things about the Druids. One of the things that some of the scraps of information that you get from Roman and Greek commentators are about Druids doing human sacrifice. And there is some evidence that in times of great trouble, they did sacrifice to their divinities, and but they had they did that in times of great peril and turmoil, and they did that for the sake of really, really, really serious problems going on in their in terms of warfare. Like prisoners of war and people caught in the act of doing something that had a death penalty to it, they would be the ones sacrificed, unfortunately. So human sacrifice is actually true, and we got evidence for it.
Well, we have to do a little sacrificing right about now, taking a break here on 21st Century Radio. Find more about our guests on the Facebook page for 21st Century Radio. Don't go away. We'll be right back with more after this.
This is Robert Moss, author of Dreaming the Soul Back Home and other books about getting yourself together and living a deeper, juicier life. You're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus. What a fantastic host he is. He's lively, he's questing, he knows that story can be the shortest route between a human being and the truth. Listening to this show, you'll hear many stories, and you might just wake up to the deeper story of your life and find the courage and the will to follow that, and that will change everything.
Thank you for staying with us. I'm your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and we return now to our guest. Secrets of the Druids, From Indo-European Origins to Modern Practices, a second edition. This one is revised edition of the Sacred Cauldron, Inner Traditions. Find a link to her website and order her book from 21st Century Radio Facebook page and subscribe to our YouTube channel, etc., etc., etc. Okay. Hi, are you still there, dear?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yes, I am.
Commercials are commercials. There's nothing we can do about it. Did the Celts and the East Indians have any contacts in prehistoric times?
Not that we know of, and you know, by the time Indo-Europeans had branched out geographically all over Europe and all the way into Iran and India and into all the way to the Ural Mountain of what's now Russia, No, the Indo-Europeans branched off into many different peoples as their languages, you know, changed over the centuries.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, you know, for example, the Baltic people, the Lithuanians and Latvians, and the old Prussians who were later Germanicized by the Germans. And then we had the Slavic people, such as Russian and Polish and Ukrainian and so forth. And, of course, we had some languages die out, like Phrygian and Illyrian and so forth. And they were Indo-European. And I can kind of, I like to give people lists of the numbers 1 through 10 in Indo-European languages so they can hear how similar they sound from one language to the other.
Would you do that
for
us?
For Celtic, let's say we'll do Irish. In da tree caher cui she shock a hawk and a deck. Deck meaning ten. We go to Latin, we get unus, duo, tres, quattuor, quinque, sex, septum, octo, non, decum. Notice the similarity. As it drifts, you go to Gothic, a Germanic language that died out in Eastern Europe, and Crimea was the last place. And they said, eins, zwei, drei, vier, fünf, sechs, Sebun Akso Neun Tehun. That meant 1 through 10. And you can notice some of the similarities with even English.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then in Sanskrit, it's Eka Dva Trayas Chatvaras Pancha Sa Sata Nava Dasa. So you notice the similarity there. And then, of course, Proto-Indo-European itself. Let's see, it goes Oinos, Duo, Tres, Treas, Quetwaters, Penque, Swex, Septum, Octo, Neon, Decum. So, similarity in that.
Thank you very much on that.
You notice the similarity between those sounds?
Yes, I did. Of course, I read your entire book, so I began to see some of those myself. You know, one of the things that I think I learned, there's so much I learned from you, and I really do appreciate your scholarship. It really, you know, some of the books that I had read earlier concerning the Druids, they sounded really very nice, but I had some doubts about them. They were a little bit too flowery in some areas. But what kind of deities did the Celtic peoples worship?
Well, they were polytheists, like most peoples were in those days. They believed in many gods and goddesses, and they worshipped them with sacrifices and offerings. The Celts weren't didn't anthropomorphize their deities as much as some of the other Europeans did, and they used crudely carved wood and probably set up a few idols in some groves or nematon. And the Greeks were really into anthropomorphizing their gods, making them look very human, and they were, yet they were superhuman. And because of that, we have all these images of what, you know, Aphrodite looked like, or Zeus, depicted as a man with a long hair and long beard, holding a spear that he made lightning out of. And so, that's the sensibilities of the Greeks, and the Romans kind of adopted some of the Greek customs, although their deities were not exactly the same as that of the Greeks. They syncretized them. This is also what they did in Gaul. When they saw a Gaulish divinity, they equated it with something that was familiar to them in the Roman pantheon. And Caesar did that in his De Bello Gallico, or his Gaulish War book. So the kind of deities that the Celts had is, one has his name on every, on nearly every section of Western Europe has the name Lugus formed into place names like Lyon, which was called Lugudunum in Latin, from the Gaulish Lugudunum. And that became the capital of Gaul for a long time, although the Druids had made the center Carnutus, which is now called Chartres in French. But the Irish are the ones that set their mythology down. But when they set it down to writing, they euhemerized the divinities as heroes and people in their past, with a succession of 5 invasions of Ireland in the so-called Yaor Gawala Éireann, which means a book of the takings or invasions of Ireland. And some scholars disagree that the Celts had a international pantheon, although it looks like a pantheon in the Larga Walla Aran, their deity names like Lua, the long arm, appears in there. And I equate him, he's like a Celtic version of Zeus, because he kills his own grandfather in a battle with Balor the Evil Eye. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of like Zeus winning his Olympian siblings, liberating them from Cronus, who had in turn had liberated the Titans from Uranus. And there's a lot of striking similarities in the stories, and they're usually structurally similar. So I could go on about that.
Would you go on just a little bit more? Because this is very interesting to me.
Well, for example, the ideology of the Indo-Europeans was about the hierarchy of people, of classes of society. Mm-hmm. In other words, they had a stratified society. And with the priesthoods being at the top with the king of the territory, and then you would have the class of the warrior nobles. And then after that, under that would be the free farmers and herders. And then they're called food producers, or usually called the free class. And then you had under them the vassals of, which would be include, they were like serfs of the Middle Ages, or like slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And they were a servile caste. They did their work directly for the farmers and herdsmen. Now, that in turn, given by the great Georges de Maizel, he called that the tripartite ideology, in which classes had gods that represented the whole class. For example, with the Teutonic Norsemen, they had Odin, Thor, Freyr, and Freya, with their warrior god being Thor. And their the class of the Vanir, which is Freyr and Freya, representing fertility and fecundity of the farmer and herdsman. And that is, among the Celts, there's a motif of when they are naming the Tuatha De Danann, which is the name of the peoples of the goddess Dana, they are talking about what may be a forming pantheon that the Celian and historians were trying to form for Ireland. They always say the formula is Lu, Nuada the Silver Arm, and then there's the Ogmios, Ogma, inventor of Boehm, or Ogum. And then you have the third class, which is the free herders and farmers. And they would have the Daida, or Dagda, as it's sometimes mispronounced. And and perhaps Bridget, whose holiday was just celebrated here recently.
Oh, Bridget, yes.
Yeah, Breed or Bridget was also a saint in the early church.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot to say about Bridget, whether we're talking about the goddess or whether we're talking about the saint. But they kind of overlap in the stories, and that makes us suspect that the Saint Bridget may have been a euhemerized version of the goddess Bridget.
I see, yeah.
But that's unclear. Most scholars remark about it, but they have not solved whether that is exactly what she was. But Breed was a powerful goddess, and it means the high one in going back to an Indo-European root. And also, they worshipped Epona, the horse goddess of Gaul, who became so popular among Roman soldiers, they even invoked her. So, and Epona actually goes back to Indo-European Epona. And so we know they're of Indo-European origin because their names have an etymology to go back so far. Even in Sanskrit, they had a goddess they called Brihati, and means the same thing, the high one, the exalted
one. The high one, yeah. Well, right now, we got to take another break here, unfortunately, but hold on to our hats out there because... next question I'm going to be asking deals with, are there any modern Druidy or Celtic groups that you could recommend? I'm sure a lot of our listeners right now are thinking about that about now. We'll be right back right after these messages.
Hi, I'm Reverend Dr. Karen Tate. I'm the author of Goddess Calling, Inspirational Messages and Meditations of Sacred Feminine Liberation Theology, and the radio show host of Voices of the Sacred Feminine Radio on Blog Talk. My website is www.karentate.com. And you've been listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus. I hope you'll read my books and discover why the spirituality of the sacred feminine is today's new liberation theology, setting us free from the domination and exploitation of patriarchy, and how that patriarchy has kept women and men from achieving their fullest potential.
Thank you for staying with us. I'm your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and we return now to our guest. Let me give a little mistake that I made some time ago, Teresa. One book that I loved for such a long time was Robert Graves' The White Goddess. Now, I had a great deal of respect for Mr. Graves, but I had little, I understand now, there's some, seems to be, he was writing an example of poetic speculation. Is that true?
Oh, that's what he called it. But did you know that later in his life he repudiated that work?
I didn't know that. Thank you for telling me. I'm glad he did.
When he was retired, I think he was living in Spain. I think that's where he retired to. I'm not sure. He repudiated the book when a fan wrote to him and said, oh, this is great, and went on and on. And he finally wrote back, well, it was a crazy book, and I didn't intend to write it. That was the exact quote of him.
Sounds like some politicians
and,
today.
Yeah, he sure had an influence on feminist neo-paganism, but the mistake he made is that he didn't understand Indo-European comparative philology. And a lot of people get in trouble when they start experimenting with it. Even I have had my doubts whether the name Loom comes from a Indo-European root meaning like, light, L-I-G-H-T, or whether it came from a root meaning to swear, as to swear an oath. And I've changed my views on that and followed that latest etymology, because it makes sense. If Lu is the god of oath that you would swear an oath to, then certainly his power had to do with contracts and agreements and information like that. In the story, he perpetuates, he's of both Fomorian and Dagonan heritage. Which and the structure of that myth is that he follows his father's people, who's Dedanan, rather than a Fomor. Fomors are a strange race They're considered giants. They're considered one-eyed, one-armed, and one-legged, which has kind of a serpentine attraction to their form. But what they did was force the Dedannans into hard labor, and they were oppressed. And so the gods over had a battle with them and won. But the other part of the story is Nudur, the silver arm, is was injured and his arm was replaced by an actual prosthetic arm provided by the god Dientek. And Dientek gives him a silver arm with silver hands. And thus his name is called in Welsh Llyslaw Erain, which means of the silver arm or silver hand. And then in Irish, he's called Nuada Arigatlav, which means the silver hand.
Mm-hmm.
So later it was restored all the way to human hand, you know, for him. And there's some stories that go with that. And Lou, the long-armed Nuada, seemed to appear to be the champion leader of the gods. And there's a story of how Lou was hidden as a child from his grandfather. That again reminds us of Zeus.
Yes, yes.
So there's a lot of parallels between Irish mythology and the lore of the Walla Éireann, but there's parallels with Greek mythology a lot. And there's the islands of the West where there's the Hesperides and in Greek mythology, and we have the Irish counterpart to it. Well, one of the things I want to bring up is, I don't know how you feel about this, is the doctrine of reincarnation.
Yes, that's the enlighten us in this area, please.
Because, you know, we have these islands where there's Chernanog, Tir Tarn Geda, there's various other places like the land of the apples, the apple orchards of Alamaca. What's it called in Irish? The land of Manannan MacLir, where he includes the Feast of Age. But we got all these stories, and they structurally suggest a world similar to Greek mythology and then similar to Hinduism, in that the reincarnation is in transmigration of souls. It's mentioned a lot by classical antiquity as the doctrine that the Druids came up with to give bravery to soldiers in battle. And they believe in it so highly that they promise to pay their debts into the next world if they get killed or die.
That's quite an advantage.
Yeah, and they wholeheartedly believed in life after death. Human souls went from one place to another, or from one to another, as Caesar can be translated on. But unlike Hinduism, we don't have a doctrine of samsara and rebirth. You're judged, your karma adds up with what you will be in the next life.
Mm-hmm.
And the object of it is moksha, liberation from samsara. But we don't have that in the Celtic religion, at least not from the myth that we can draw from in medieval Irish tradition. And we're never made it really completely clear by the classical authors talking about Gauls and their beliefs. So all we can say is that they had a form of reincarnation. Now, in my previous book, I had called it metagenetic rebirth through family lines, which is like inheriting your soul.
Hmm.
But that's more of a Teutonic belief than a Celtic one. That appears in Norse myth. So I redid that chapter and talked about it in terms of we don't have a medieval comprehensive belief in reincarnation, obviously, so of Gaelic, Irish, and Scottish Gaelic tradition. But there is one thing that kind of hints at something is of that nature is in the song Loch Lomond, where it's about soldiers who've been captured by the British in a war that took place near Carlisle. Mm. And he says, the singer sings, you'll take the high road and I'll take the low road, which means one's going to be executed and the other gets to go home free. That's the one taking the high road.
Mm.
The one taking the low road is going to be executed, but he says he'll be in Scotland before him.
Mm. Oh,
because he'll travel as a spirit, which is an interesting explanation on that.
Well, are there any modern Druidy or Celtic groups that you recommend?
Well, let me see. We've got one of the people I acknowledged in my book was Donald Irvin, who runs the Sylvan Celtic Fellowship and out of North Carolina. And That's a good organization. There's some other organizations. There's the ADF, or Ardnoriaigh Féin, which means our own Druidism, which has got some groups in the United States. And then I participated a bit with and corresponded with the Creighton Goldic Celtic Hovedel, which is a Breton group that has druids, and they go back to the Bardic druids of the 19th century, like Obeodio over in England, order of bards, ovates, and druids. And let me see, and I could think of a few others, but I can't remember their names. But there's a lot of druid groups in the world. The druids of Quebec are enthusiastic followers of the Indo-European tradition, and they are kind of work with the druids of Brittany. And then there's some new ones popping up in Ireland, so I'd have to research it to get the names of them. I think there's the Druid Order of Ireland, and then there's some other writers who have done what we call Celtic Reconstructionism, which are trying to, now for some reason, people are scared of the Indo-European hypothesis, but I don't understand that. But a lot of people just don't understand how important the Indo-European past is, because it is from that which Celtic sprung out of as one of the traditions. And you know, and for some reason, we Celts are so popular nowadays with a lot of people who are not of Celtic cultural heritage but have adopted it.
Why do you think that is?
There's a lot of mystery and romanticism mm-hmm. attached to the idea of the Druids of being very powerful priesthood. But to live in a society like that, does not appeal to most people. I mean, and to reconstruct a society that they lived in would be tribal and socially stratified. It's very antithesis of what we have in modern day first world countries. We don't have tribalism and petty kings and stuff like that. So they could only do it ceremonially. You know, they wouldn't be able to do it in actuality.
We have a ceremonial break coming up right now on 21st Century Radio at the top of the hour with our guest Teresa Cross, Secrets of the Druids from Indo-European Origins to Modern Practices, Second Edition, Revised Edition of the Secret Cauldron, Inner Traditions. Find a link to her website and order her book from 21stcenturyradio.com. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and our executive producer and research assistant is Laura Kortner, and our engineer is Anita Brockington. Again, our guest tonight is an expert on Druids and the ancient Celtic class of religious leaders, legal authorities, lore keepers, etc., etc., etc. It's Teresa Cross, and the book is The Secrets of the Druids, From Indo-European Origins to Modern Practices, Second Edition, Revised Edition of The Sacred Cauldron, Inner Traditions. Find a link to her website and order her book from 21stcenturyradio.com. Facebook page. That's right. Now, let's see. Teresa, Dr. Stephen E. Flowers said that this book is written from within Druidism. What does that mean?
Well, at the time that I wrote the book, I was a practicing Druid. I retired from it decades later and changed my faith to being Catholic, and then eventually I became an Episcopalian. So I no longer worship the old gods, but I still have the knowledge of it. So, in fact, I'm working on a book on Celtic Christianity now, which may take up where Secrets of the Druids leaves off, you know, and how they integrated Christianity into the Celtic ideology of Ireland, and then eventually Scotland, and then it came down to Northumbria, too.
Wow.
That would be interesting. From within the mindset of the Druids, of the Celts. Frankly, I still find the ancient antiquities of the languages and what happened among the Celtic peoples is because my own heritage is Scottish, Irish, Welsh, and there's a little bit of English and French in there too, but I am mainly, I identify with Scotland
mm-hmm.
as my ethnic heritage, and I speak some Gaelic, Scottish Gaelic, and know a lot of old Irish and Irish phrases and stuff too, but Stephen Flowers minored in Celtic and studied Old Irish under Ruth Lehman at UT Austin
mm-hmm.
back in the I guess that would have been the 70s or 80s. My academic credentials is that I studied literature and got a B.A. in that, and then worked on a master's in education. So,
well, let's,
that may explain it.
It sure does. Well, what languages are part of the Celtic branch of the Indo-European family?
Well, in ancient times, Gaulish was a major language because it was spoken in France, Belgium, and Switzerland. And it had made its way into Asia Minor, Turkey, as we call it today. There was the Galatians that are spoke of in the New Testament. They actually might have been bilingual when in Greek and Gaulish during the time that St. Paul had converted them to Christianity. We know from St. Jerome, which is the Latinization of your very name, Hieronymus.
That's correct.
St. Jerome found that they were still speaking Gaulish in Trier, the Treveri, as he called them. And Trier is now in Germany, but it was on the border of Gaul and was kind of an important city at the time. But that was in the 5th century. I mean, I go all the way up into the turn of the century, from 5th century to the 6th century of the Common Era. And so I find that intriguing, that he said he made a comparison of the Gaulish of the Galatians with the Gaulish of Trier. So I would think that they have been dialects of some form of Gaulish, pre-Celtic.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been inscriptions that have, and lead tablets that have turned up in the ancient Gaulish language. So I thought some people were kind of attracted to that. So I put an appendix in the Secrets of the Druids, in which there's a simplified Gaulish grammar.
That's helpful.
In there. And the first edition had a lot of Gaulish and Celtic in it, and I dropped it in favor of Old Irish and used Old Irish for the terminology in the book.
Who were
Go ahead.
Who were the Proto-Indo-Europeans?
That's a controversial subject. The homeland has been thought of as being in what is now Russia and Ukraine area of Eastern Europe, and it spread westward and it spread eastward. There was a people called the Scythians, Scythians, who lived in that part of the world later. And their language was related to Old Persian.
Oh.
And they may have had an influence on the Gauls because they invented pants for riding in.
Oh.
Wearing trousers instead of wearing robes. And
do you remember?
They also. Go ahead.
Do you remember what time that was? How many decades or centuries ago that was? Pants.
They were in that region from 500 BC in that time all the way up to the Christian era into the times, because some Scythians may have been converted to Christianity via the Goths,
mm-hmm.
Who are Germanic people who went out east like that and may have intermixed with Scythians, because we have survival of people descended from the Scythians in the Caucasus Mountains. They're called the Ossets, O-S-S-E-T-S, and they are descended from Scythian-like tribes, and
is that
they
how?
Became Orthodox Christians. Huh?
Is that how we know so much about them?
We know a lot from Greek commentating on them, like Herodotus, probably about 300 B.C., something around that time period. Mm-hmm. And but there was trade with them, and there was they didn't carry any written records at all. So all we know is from oral tradition that was handed down among the Sarmatians, Scythians, and
mm-hmm.
people known as the Alans, another tribe. In fact, it was the kingdom of Alania. And they ended up being mostly, they're called Iron and Digor. And the Iron people are Christian, and the Digor people are Muslim. Yeah, that's right. And that's the modern and descendants. They did preserve an epic called the Nart-Yamanga epic, in which there was a cup of the Narts and there was a quest for various things. And it resembles in many ways Arthurian tradition.
How does one become a modern-day druid?
Well, I would recommend they become as knowledgeable as they can on that kind of lore. And it took in the time that Caesar was writing about the Gauls and the Britons, he said it took up to 20 years to become a druid.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have in the Irish record is the Fildi, taken about 15 years of curriculum. So they were trained from the time they were young onward. This is according to what level that you wanted to be. There was the Vates, V-A-T-E-S, which short were the prophets, is the one who did the prognosticating and forecasts of what would happen and what might happen.
Okay, so...
And usually prophets.
Oh. You mentioned a little bit about your education and how it relates to the Druid book. Could you tell us more about your education as it relates to the Druid book? Because this is one of the things I'm so impressed by in your work and why it's so accurate.
Well, as an undergraduate at UT Dallas, I studied... interdisciplinary thing, just because I was going for a Bachelor of Arts in English Literature, I spent a lot of time taking classes on things I was interested in, too, and one of them was mythology, another was linguistics, another was literature of antiquity, and all that contributed to giving me the tools to do my own research, so I took advantage of that. But my profession was that I was an English teacher, and I was teaching 12th grade English when I finally got tired of it. I decided they were putting in metal detectors for the students brought weapons into the school, and I decided, well, maybe I should get out of this and do something with civil service.
I guess
so. I went to work for the Internal Revenue Service and worked there for over 11 years. And
How did you find working with the Internal Revenue? How did it work out?
How did I find it?
No, how did it work out for you?
What did I thought of?
Yeah.
It was very... the more I progressed in it, the harder the job got until finally, and I was going through a divorce and I had a nervous breakdown from it that I quit from that point on and retired.
Mm-hmm. But you have a strong... I'm sorry, go ahead.
It was a very stressful job.
Yes, I would imagine. Probably still is.
Yeah. Things would change every time we got a new commissioner, so, you know, I worked during the Bill Clinton era and later the Bush, and I have no idea what it was during Trump's administration.
Well, you have a strong connection, and you mentioned this before, to your Scottish and Irish heritage. How has that shaped your interest?
Does that shape my what?
How does that shape your interest, the connection with the Scottish-Irish heritage? That's a strong connection.
Well, my sister did genealogy on us, and I did a DNA test, and she did a DNA test, and we turned out to be quite a bit Scots, although my religion was at one time Roman Catholicism. I rejected it because it was not friendly to LGBT people.
That's for sure. Very unfriendly. Hopefully that'll change in the long run.
Yeah, I became an Episcopalian because they accept people like me. I started a transition in 2005 and became a woman in 2015. So I am a transgender woman myself.
Well, congratulations. I'm glad that we have a new administration which is going to support those kind of things.
Yeah.
It does make a very...
We're glad about that.
Yeah, so I think the whole world is glad about that, the big change. Our country has fallen back considerably in regards to higher consciousness and the sciences, et cetera. And I'm glad that we're moving in a direction I think we're all going to be very proud of. We're all one people on one planet. That's my bias, and that we should be able to easily work together. And unfortunately, that's not what was happening for our past 4 years. There's a totally different kind of a country we had here, with a president who didn't even know anything about a constitution, which that's criminal, as far as I'm concerned.
That was scary.
Yes, it was, and it still is right now. Oh, gosh. Oh, we got to take a break here on 21st Century Radio with our guest, Teresa Cross, Secrets of the Druids, from Indo-European Origins to Modern Practices.
This is Jim Willis, author of Lost Civilizations, The Secret Histories and Suppressed Technologies of the Ancients. You are listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus. Please contact me, though, at www.jimwillis.net to learn about my other books and projects, because I'd love to hear from you.
And we're back. I'm Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and we return now to our guest. Okay, my next question for $30,000. Okay, here goes. Tell us about some of the various druidic groups that you associated with in your past.
Well, we had the Craig Geltic Holvidel of Brittany, and that was the last one I had contact with before returning to my faith Abrahamic religion of Christianity. One of the things that led me to go back to being a Christian was my study of Vedic literature and Hindu tradition. I run into a philosophy called Veda, Aveda, Vedanta, which is different from most people practice Advaita Vedanta. Well, and what that means is that they believe we're all one with the Supreme Godhead.
Mm-hmm.
That's Advaita Vedanta. And it means non-dual. But in Veda Advaita Advaita Vedanta, we believe that we seem to be one with the divine Godhead, but we are different. We are dependent upon the Brahman or Supreme Godhead. And that's what got me back into looking into Christianity again,
mm-hmm.
because I believed in the incarnation.
When you were... Go ahead.
Well, in case in point now, I was attracted to the theology of John Scotusaria Jaina, who was an Irish scholastic teacher over in France in the 9th century. So he was deemed a heretic because he seemed to be a pantheist. But really, he was a panentheist. He believed God was in everything imminent,
mm-hmm.
and he also believed in, he was also separate from everything. at the same time. It seems paradoxical, but the panentheism believes everything is God, and that God is also beyond as well as in everything, beyond everything. So I was attracted to that philosophy and started studying the theology of the church. So I was thinking of writing a book on Celtic Christianity because it's become a hot topic, and I am also a member of the community of Aidan and Hilda. So
we're
enjoying that now.
When you were you a Roman Catholic at one time?
Yeah.
Did you serve on the altar?
No, I didn't.
Oh, I was going to ask that. The reason why I asked that question is I was going to be a priest at one time. And fortunately, I got involved with the Dead Sea Scrolls and other things, and that changed me radically from that standpoint. But the Mass of the Holy Eucharist is some magical experience. I used to see things up on the altar during the process of that particular work, which I would want to talk to at times with the priests, but I was never allowed to until I became very close to a number of nuns. And when I mentioned to them, "Do you see the sparks and the other lights that are up there going on during the Mass of the Holy Eucharist?" And they said, "Certainly, certainly." And I said, "Well, how come the priests all say no, they don't see any of that?" How would you answer something like that?
Well, there are certain charismas that God puts on people. They got a gift for something, which usually becomes what they love to do for a living.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody has a purpose in life, or dharma. And St. Paul talks about it, and some priests, they just don't have that gift. They may have a gift for something else, like being a priest is a gift of a vocation, and holy orders. But when they're up there, consecrating the Mass as the sacrifice, it commemorates, there are so many commemorations in it, and there are so many people who get caught up in the consecration of the host and wine into the body and blood of Jesus. And some people catch it symbolically, and some people don't. Some people think it's literal. And some of the Protestant sects that broke off in the 16th century said it was only symbolic. It was just a memorial.
Mm-hmm.
And that was condemned as heresy. But in Irish Christianity, they saw it both ways.
Yes.
Because I read a old Irish treatise on the Holy Eucharist that was included in the back of the Stowe Missal. And it talks about, it tells you how the Eucharist, what each part of the Mass symbolizes. And it's pretty powerful stuff.
I'll see.
So, and in fact, Druidic sacrifices were kind of like Eucharist in that sense too. They believe they were building the world out of mesocosm of the sacrifice of animals and people partaking of it. So some of the sacrifices seem a little bizarre to us today. And with that, I could reveal what the real one of the secrets of the Druids that people always wonder: what did a Druid do
as
a sacrifice?
Mm-hmm. I'm all ears.
They'd be surprised. They'd be surprised to know that the Druid, like a Brahmin priest of Vedic Indian sacrifices before they became vegetarian, was that they sat to the side, watched the whole procedure, and made sure no mistakes were made.
Hmm.
They didn't really do anything physical. And the reason we know this, the reason I know it, is because the bardic performance of a fili composed a poem, and it's usually a praise poem of the king or the champion of their warriors, and they wrote them, or they composed them rather, that when a performance of it was taken up, they were the master of, the filly was the master of ceremonies. He didn't perform, or she didn't perform, her actual work. It was actually performed by a rhapsodist, one who sang and chanted the poem. And the filly was there to conduct it. So you see that the being master of ceremonies, they were judging and presiding over.
I see.
Interesting, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
I mean, they did like the Brahmins of India, and there are still Brahmins in India.
Mm-hmm.
They're a class or a caste, but there are still those that go to memorize the Vedas by rote. I mean, they actually sing them over and over again until they memorize the literary piece, even though it later got written down.
I understand you are currently a member of a historical reenactment group called the Adrian Empire, where you play...
Yeah.
I don't think I'm going to pronounce this right. Clarissa Celtic harp? No, it's a Clarissa Celtic harp?
Oh, the Clarissic.
A Clarissic, yeah. Thank you.
I have a Clarissic is a Celtic style harp.
Well, tell us all about?
It's like Society of Creative Anachronism. Which we put on the garb, and we go and we do, we watch battles, and we participate in various guilds in which we do certain things.
Are there specific...
Take up a hobby, like...
Are there specific...
Sewing. Huh?
Are there specific battles that you would reenact? Are there certain battles that are so important to that particular history and time that you deliberately reenact them?
Yeah, well, we don't reenact actual battles. Like a lot of groups do. We have our own little kingdoms, and we have our own titles and everything that you earn. And we basically fulfill our hobbies. And and sometimes there are battles, and they're reenacting what a medieval battle would be like.
But right now we're battling at the break that we need to take our final break on 21st Century Radio with our guest, Teresa Cross, Secrets of the Druids, from the Indo-European Origins to Modern Practices, second edition. We'll be right back right after these messages.
My name is Sarah Taft, and I'm the author of Mary Magdalene Shaman. You can see it on my website, which is at sarahtaft.com. And in this, you can see my paintings of Mary Magdalene and read my relationship to her and how she healed me through a liver transplant. You're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus. I hope you enjoy yourself.
And we're back. I'm Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio. Learn more about us at www.21stcenturyradio.com. Of course, our guest is Teresa Cross, and we suggest that you purchase this copy of the book, and we could, if we could bribe you into it by giving you a copy of our books, if you purchase a copy of this book. Obviously, we want you to have a library so that when you have problems like we have today in the world, you have something to read and learn.
Yeah.
And not just watch cowboys and Indians on television. How are the Scottish Highlanders related to the Irish?
Oh, yeah. That's an interesting topic. Irish people around the 4th century began colonizing their kingdom of Dal Riada to Scotland. Mm. I would say this, I think this happened around the 300s. And part of Scotland was Pict land. And that's a whole other topic that could take an hour to explain. But there were Picts there, and the Scots were Irish, were Gaels.
Mm-hmm.
These words are all kind of synonymous. You have the Gaels or the Scots, Scoti, as they call it in Latin. And they had landed in southwestern Scotland, just north of the Welsh, of Strathclyde, because Welsh weren't confined to Wales in those days, and they set up a colony at Dunad, and they spread the Gaelic language there, and St. Columba was the one who was exiled himself to the Isle of Iona and founded a monastery there. And anyway, but there were a lot of Scots who were still pagan in those days, and so Scotland inherited the culture that they brought with them from Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And it still had close contact with each other up until the 1600s, and the languages were diverting from each other by that time, and it developed into Scottish Gaelic, which is different to Irish in many ways, and it's very similar. Their verb, subject, object is the word order that they use, and you can find a lot of similarities between Irish dialects, particularly of Northern Ireland, Donegal, and similarities with Scottish Gaelic. And I took up that language, although I had been a member of the Gaelic League. I lived in Dallas. I learned a lot of Irish. I taught Boomerang Irish, which is beginner's Irish. I converted over to studying the Scots language, which is different enough to be confusing. But I overcome that.
Were the Celts matriarchal, and if not, were there any ways that their culture was woman-centered?
Women had a lot of power. Women had the rights of inheriting their own property, and there was at one time seven forms of marriage, where, you know, it was often called hand fasting. And then there's women inherited their own property, so if they divorce, they retained it. They didn't lose it to the marriage.
That's most important. So, that's most important.
Because, and they did...
It's just that women have all had such a terrible situation in regards to that marriage when they lose everything. In the past, they lost everything when they were divorced.
Yeah.
It was terrible. You note that the whole cycle of time and space, as we know it, is an endless cycle of creation and destruction. How would you compare
and
that?
Recreation. Yeah. Oh. Indo-European belief. There was the Gaul who was asked, what is it you fear? I fear nothing but that the sky should fall. And another, they believed that, and this is an Indo-European thing too, is they believed that fire and water could destroy the earth, but that the human soul is indestructible.
Yes.
Even though fire and water could prevail. So water was considered an important boundary, kind of like in Greek mythology, it was the river Styx and the river Lethe, which you cross over with the boatman Chiron, with his ferry, and they put coins on people's, on the body's eyes as a payment to Chiron for burying them across the Lethe and the Styx, river Styx. And what we have in Celtic mythology, we don't have a story about that, because obviously that was pagan doctrine that was repressed. But the Christian belief in the destruction of the world and a new Jerusalem being built and paradise and all that is very similar to what they already believed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the key elements as to how Christianity caught a foothold with, as to St. Patrick and St. and Palladius. The world in the Norse mythology is similar. They believe in Ragnarok, the twilight of the gods, and the and fire and ice being the end of it. But there were similar ideas in India, and the Greeks believed in certain ages, the Bronze Age, or the Age of Iron, and the and so on and so forth. Let's see, I can't give any details, but if you read Works and Days by Hesiod, you get an idea of what that count, how that works.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an endless cycle of creation, destruction, and recreation.
How much can we rely on classical sources?
Well, there's the so-called Posidonian sources of a guy who had actually traveled in Gaul and learned from the natives, but there was a... the other commentators from a later time were romanticizing the Druids, so you got to be careful with some of this information, because they were holding them up as noble savages.
Yeah.
So either the propaganda was very pro Druidic, or it was very anti-Druidic. You know, thinking of the world as different barbarians, and you know, the Greeks thought they were the best, and they looked down at the other people. So there was some prejudice going on.
Well, sure is. Now, this question I'm going to give you right now is kind of tough, but we got some time to do it. How are our physical bodies microcosms of the multiverse?
Oh yeah. Well,
we got 2 minutes.
This as a sacrifice was a mesocosm, which means a middle world scale. The body is the individual, and the various parts of, there was stories in Indo-European mythology of how a giant is taken and he's slain, and his body becomes, his bones become the stones, his flesh becomes the soil, his blood becomes the waters, and his hair becomes the vegetation, and all, and so on, all these analogs, and these. It works both ways. You know, you can be a giant who's dismembered and they make the universe out of him, or on the other hand, we return to the earth in those forms, but the soul prevails. Analogs are taken from a mythology that doesn't exist anymore in the Celtic group, but we get it in the Norse tradition when they slain the giant Ymir, Y-M-I-R, and they make the universe out of them.
Well, there were giants. The Smithsonian Institute is dead wrong, saying there are no such things, but there were giants, and there are many books out in this particular area. And we're out of time. Teresa, thank you very much for joining us. I learned so much from you, and I greatly appreciate your work.